Hello, and welcome to the Art of the Cut podcast, brought to you in partnership with Boris of Facts. I'm Steve Hallfish, ACE. I'm a working film, TV, and documentary editor. Over the last 10 years, I've done more than 400 interviews with the world's best editors. Welcome to episode 11 of season 10. I've been using Boris of Facts products for 30 years, and I'm proud to partner with them to bring you some great filmmaking content. Today on Art of the Cut, we're talking with Oscar winner Joe Walker, ACE. I interviewed Joe in person just before the Ace Eddies at his home on a rainy Los Angeles day. You may hear some of that in the background. Joe was one of the very first Art of the Cut guests on March 18, 2014, a decade ago, when he was nominated for an Oscar, a BAFTA, and an Ace Eddie for his editing of 12 Years a Slave. Since then, we've talked about his work on Sicario, another Ace Eddie nomination, Arrival, BAFTA and Oscar nominations and an Ace Eddie win, Blade Runner 2049, a BAFTA and an Ace Eddie nomination, then Widows, then Dune, for which he was nominated for a BAFTA and an Ace Eddie and won the Oscar. Then most recently we talked when he cut The Creator, and now Dune 2. Eight great discussions that you should go back and have a listen to. Joe has a lovely ability to edit instinctively, but be able to explain where that instinct is coming from. Plus, you just want to grab a beer or a cup of tea and listen, just to feel part of a great, fun conversation. Before I hop into our discussion with Joe, a brief thank you to our partner, Boris of Facts. I've been using Boris of Facts and Sapphire for 30 years, so they're not just a sponsor to me. I feel like they've been a partner in my cutting room for decades, helping me to deliver on the creative visions of my clients, directors, and producers. For all of us, our work is about bringing a creative idea to the screen, and for me, Boris of Facts is one of the important tools that I use to do that. To see how they can help you on your latest project, head on over to borisfx.com and check out the Boris of Facts suite, which includes Sapphire, Continuum, Mocha Pro, Silhouette, and Optics, all in a low-cost monthly or annual subscription. If you want to read this interview with great visual support like Joe's timelines, you can go to borisfx.com/blog/AOTC. That site also has other great filmmaking content, so keep that bookmarked. And now, Oscar-winning editor Joe Walker, ACE.
We have been talking to each other for 10 years.
Good Lord.
I can't believe it.
We should put up a plaque.
I don't even know how many interviews. I was going to look up how many interviews. It's got to be 7 or 8.
It's all of them.
Yeah, it's all of them. So thanks for being such a good friend for the last 10 years and having wonderful things to say. Would it be possible to edit this movie without subwoofers?
Well, definitely not to listen to it. You know, after Dune 1, we did have a number of cinema owners complaining that it was destroying the fabric of their screens and that the railings were rattling and they popped a few subs. So, believe it or not, Dune Part 2 was our attempt to be slightly more adventurous in the upper ranges. No, I don't think it's possible.
I love the movie. I have all kinds of questions. One of them is about dissolves. After Paul says that he believes in revenge, there are a series of dissolves to flashbacks or visions. What guides you when you decide to use dissolves instead of cuts?
So Paul and Jessica are kind of alone in a sort of canteen with the Fremen and looking very excluded indeed. And because Paul is eating food contaminated with spice and he's sensitive to it and slips into trance, we suggest that by using a camera flare, we used actually, I don't think of it, funnily enough, as a dissolve.
Oh, sure. Maybe they weren't.
Yeah. I'm not hostile to dissolves. Mm. When I was a rookie editor, a mentor advised me to avoid them unless they became part of the story. He hated the concept of, if you can't fix it, mix it. If you can't solve it, dissolve it. But in this particular scene, we're talking about a series of supers. Mm. We had this amazing result from a certain chip that responded to sunlight and flaring in a particular way. And Denny had spotted it while he was doing a pickup shoot, I think, actually in California. And it had this sort of striated effect, a bit like your eyelashes, and it felt like it needed to become an iconic part of the film. It also helps me to just sort of lose continuity completely. You're just in his headspace, and with a sound that reminds you of a psychedelic experience, I suppose.
Mm. And then as they carry, this is something I'm always fascinated by, which is, and it's a horrible word to use with a fellow editor, but shoe leather. It's got a negative connotation, but what I mean by it is anytime you're showing travel, there has to be a purpose, right? There has to be a reason. And as they're carrying Jameis's body back to the siege, we watch the travel. What's the value of that? Because you could, right, if you wanted to, just cut to them arriving at the siege and you'd be done.
Well, that's a lot of subtext going on in that moment. You sort of see Charney's status in the Fremen crowd, which you haven't been able to see before. I mean, part two has been designed completely as a standalone film. You should be able to watch it without having seen part one. And the kind of goal was to slip in as much necessary background surreptitiously into the story. And you know very little about the Fremen really in part one because of limited screen time, honestly. Danny always talked about part one as being the appetizer and this being the main course, where everything's set up and you can just enjoy a damn good action-adventure story. And so that little moment there, Paul wants to carry the body himself, which is a great sign of his respect for the Fremen. But the person who has to relinquish the strap that's holding the dead body defers to Charney, and there's a tension between those two people. It's a very unspoken moment where you sense there's trouble ahead for somebody harboring a non-Fremen, an outsider. And of course, that's going straight to the main theme of the first half of the movie, which is Paul having to paddle very hard to be able to kind of establish himself with the Fremen to survive. And I forgot to say, the whole journey to the Sitch sets up an idea that the Fremen are completely hidden and at this point in the story, virtually unassailable.
There's a wonderful moment with Chani and Paul as she talks about wind traps.
Mm.
And it's kind of a little, it's not quite romantic, but you drop her voice out of the discussion. She starts to explain how the wind traps work and then you never hear it. Why?
In that case, to allow us to just appreciate the images of these two people getting closer. Mm. And the important thing there was to kind of break away from the dialogue. The dialogue wasn't important. Mm-hmm. The looks are, you know, the fondness, the closeness, but also the acknowledgement that Charney is the only one who really believes he's going to make it. You know, even then, she only really responds to Paul, I think, when he proves himself as a warrior. The other big reason for playing some of that sequence mute was to allow Hans to enter the fray with what becomes a kind of very strong theme. There was actually, you know, that was one of the main quests with Hans Zimmer. We were trying to kind of find a piece of music for a love theme. And Hans, if you, you know, I think by his own admission would say that there aren't that many in the catalogue. You know, he's known for pounding and and a hugely Teutonic sense of fate, you know. But weirdly, Hans, God bless the man, he, when we finished part one, he carried on writing. We were both sent like CDs full of new music. And one of those tracks ended up as being the opening piece for his live show. He went around Europe and did a massive world tour. And the opening with the singer Loire featured this variation of the Atreides theme. It's a beautiful arrangement. It's Pedro, who's his woodwind player, and Loire, and I think there's cello and synthesizers.
I've talked to couple of sound guys, Walter Murch being one, Randy Tom being another, about the importance of giving space for sound design and score. So that's interesting. Because you can just wall-to-wall dialogue and, you know, laser blasts if you wanted to. But
interestingly, that scene, I actually cut it without sound. Isn't that crazy? I cut a dialogue scene between the two of them without you listening to the sound, and we figured the sound out a little bit later. There was one key thing from Charney, which is the opening shot. The important thing was to pick the right shots and the right looks, and then go back and then think of it as well, they're moving their lips, we ought to have the dialogue. I mean, you know, there's been some recent discussion about burdensome amounts of dialogue in film because of the influence of television. But from my background in Britain, it's probably something I recognise more as the heritage of radio and theatre rather than television. Mm-hmm. And cinema, to me, the stuff that I really celebrate comes from somewhere slightly different. I watched an amazing film, you know, far too late I came to it, but a film called Portrait of a Lady on Fire. Mm-hmm. And it's so charged. But actually, at the end of it, I kind of thought, I don't remember them really speaking.
2 or 3 years ago, right?
That's right. And there's never a moment lacking tension. And it's not achieved through necessarily dialogue. That's not to say I don't appreciate great dialogue, which I really do. And we spend, I have to say, hours and hours and hours finessing, improving, trying to kind of get the best clarity. Generally in the story, clarity, you know, it's a hyper-narrative. And our aim in Dune, which is a vast ensemble piece with a complex story and complex backgrounds, and Frank Herbert's almost fractal approach to storytelling, we had to have utter clarity and delivery of ideas.
I kind of think TV is so dialogue driven because in the early days you couldn't really have very cinematic images. And you're kind of just looking at a small screen. You know, what are you going to do? You got to tell me a story with talking. I don't know.
That's maybe. And let's not forget that early television speaker technology was closer and designed to the telephone, built to maximize vocal range over other things. But, you know, in cinema, we're a lot more free, and this was mixed in Dolby Atmos native. So sound was always kind of a very key strategy. And that really means building up the sound from day one. We were working with our friends in sound in New Zealand and here in Los Angeles from day one of the shoot. I cleared out a whole load of paperwork the other day, which was us communicating to Dave Whitehead and Martin Kwok, who at that point were working on the arena gladiatorial scene, a roadmap of where the peaks and troughs of that moment should be. And me and Denny had broken it down into 30 pieces and were identifying where the 10s were, the 11s, if you like,
right.
Fade pulling off his shield and Lanville being stabbed. And it's right from the outset, we need to create something that doesn't sound like a 21st century sport event. It can't be NFL. Mm-hmm. And Denny had also developed a number of behaviors for the Harkonnens, the way that they clasp their hands together and they don't clap. So massive sport events with tens of thousands of people not clapping, you have to do something. So we were engaging from day one of the shoot with the sound team to say, you know, let's have a look at Haka, the Maori chant. Dave Whitehead offered that up and did a kind of fantastic Harkonnen Haka. And then let's have a look at stamping on this massive arena, you know, and building into the fabric of the cut.
And they're giving you like a toolbox of sounds?
They were giving me stems, actually, from early on. In my timeline, right in the middle of the timeline, was always kind of pre-mixed dialogue, spot dialogue, added crowd, all that kind of stuff. They recorded at some point a huge group of heavy metal rockers to kind of amplify the kind of psychotic nature of the crowd.
I have a note about a hard cut from the explosion of the spice harvester to the Fremen celebrating. Why not allow the explosion to play out? Was there just not enough VFX budget?
It just plays beautifully, the rhythm of it. To me, it does. It's like you ride the wave.
I've heard talk to so many people that if you let the explosion happen and die off, now all the energy is gone and you've got to pick that up with the next scene.
I mean, I think we discovered that cut fairly early in the fine cutting process, like a week in. There was more stuff, there was more banter between Timotei and Zendaya in the tent, and yeah, you could have had the spice harvester blowing up a lot more. But story comes first. you know, he's in. That's the high point. Paul's in. And you mark that moment straight away rather than finding it.
Yeah.
You know, I'm searching for some hard cuts in the film for rhythm and for energy. There's a lot, you know, when Paul goes to the assembly chamber, you couldn't get harder. Sticking a percussion-only downbeat, moving fast towards a tundra of black volcanic rock. Mm. It's bold. And I found something. Here's a little thing I found when I was working in dubbing on 35mm, that if you're doing a hard bang on a cut, put it half a frame early and it really feels like it's on the cut.
What about what I call the macro editing of the storylines of Paul and Fade? They're separate, but inevitably they're going to join.
It's interesting, you know, in the original script, the story of Paul and Fade were more intercut. And it was something that we, you know, one way of putting it is that we just allowed those buttresses to kind of climb into the air a little longer, so that you saw the whole rise of each of them. The really nice thing in that kind of build-up, I think, is the fact that the film accommodates not only huge action-adventure big set pieces like the Worm Ride, but you also really invest in the intimate moments. And the thing that happens before the Worm Ride is a tiny little scene in a still tent between Charney and Paul, and he's woken up from a vision of the South. Which reminds me, something we worked hard to generate was a clear sense of what the South represents to Paul. So there's a lot of references to the fundamentalists of the South. But not only that, it also has its own visual look. It's a sort of hostile environment compared to the North, which one assumes is extremely hostile to start with.
Right.
But there's a line that Irulan has, which I really love, that sums it up, which is, "Nothing can live there without faith." And it sets up this idea that in his nightmares, he's being dragged south, and he knows that that's going to trigger a holy war.
Mm-hmm. Tell me a little bit about how the Worm Ride was filmed.
They had a worm unit. It was a splinter unit, and it was directed by Tania Lapointe, who's a producer on this film. She has a real affinity for choreographing action, and every one of those shots is very, very hard won. If you imagine a lot of them, they are throwing several tons of dust and crap at an actor who's on some kind of gimbaled stage that's being angled down. And
how long did they shoot?
It was actually, I looked it up the other day, that there were 44 days of shoot. So cutting a scene like that, it was coming in pretty much, it's like having a jigsaw puzzle that's arriving just one piece at a time. And it's sort of, you're constantly reassessing. And in that sequence, I think there was a little bit of economy in there where we found things were duplicating. We didn't want to do that. We wanted everything to be dynamic. Denny once said to me, this film should be less like Lawrence of Arabia and more like Chuck Jones' Roadrunner. And in fact, if you look in my cutting room, I've got, you know, Chris printed out a picture of Roadrunner. It's on the wall, just as a reminder.
That's pretty funny. When you cut a scene like that, that has a huge amount of amazing, powerful sound effects, do you cut on mute?
I was building up the sound always on that sequence. Just needed that power. Yes, I mean, often I kind of turn speakers off as a reference, and then, you know, I'll cut something ignoring the sound. The trouble is, it's just a practical thing. I've got 36 sound channels. They're all staggered and overlaid. So if you're adjusting one image, you're adjusting 36 cuts. It's a lot. So the most efficient way to adjust that kind of sequence is to turn the sound off, cut the sequence, and then work on the sound to kind of knit it back together again. Yeah. Sometimes I just want to feel the rhythm of things in my head in silence, and then you can kind of complement it with the sound.
I would think that for that worm riding scene, the production sounds useless.
There was none, actually. They didn't record it. They didn't record only the stuff with Charney and Stilgar, but there was nothing from the worm unit. You know, it would have been a fan noise.
Mm-hmm. Talk about the build-up to the Chani kiss scene. You talked about the idea that it's a romance, and I just felt that tension. You know it's going to happen, and you want it to happen, But you also don't want to give it too early, right? You could just...
Yeah. Charney can't be a shoo-in, right? I mean, she's a tough Fremen warrior. And Paul had to earn his right to be there with her. You know, I don't know if there are that many actors that can carry off that scene quite as well as they did. It was really beautiful getting the dailies. It was like that scene virtually didn't change. It's, you know, Denny always pays me the greatest compliment of not changing things when they work. And the Charney Paul scene was pretty much unchanged, I'd say. It was just very clear what the path through the scene was from the dailies. And it's kind of beautiful material. You know, Paul's desire to be equal with her, you know. A great deal of trouble shooting all that stuff. You know, you can't step on a dune. You know, these things were ring-fenced and, you know, it makes it very hard to say to Denny, I think we should drop something, because in some cases they built a road. It's, you know, I will always appreciate just how hard it is to film there.
There's a second Paul nightmare near the end of the film. Can you talk about that? Cutting that?
There's a lot of flashes towards the end. There's a big build-up where, you know, to protect the Fremen, Paul needs to go south. And Stilgar is urging him to go south. His mother has prepared the way. But he knows that that's going to trigger a holy war. And it's very clear what his fears are, which kind of, there's a few nightmare visions of a woman's figure walking through thousands of people who are starving and dying. And then the visions become very personal. It's Charney, who he's starting to see suffering in his nightmares. So as the film progresses and there's more pressure on him, I was using more and more little stabs just to constantly remind us of what's stopping him. You know, we're inside his head. More and more and more.
Florence Pugh's character comes in pretty late in the movie. Did you feel the need to keep her alive in some way?
Well, we generated an additional diary entry at one point where she explains Jessica in the South. That was part of this strategy of trying to kind of make abundantly clear what does the South represent, so that when he does go there, you know exactly what the choice is.
But it also allowed her to kind of come back into the audience's consciousness that she's...
Irulan is, you know, in the book, she's there in every chapter. It's a sense of what happens in the future when a historian starts to collate and collect. And she's embedded with the Bene Gesserit and the Emperor, so she's amongst the most powerful people. She's tracking the events from the, you know, million feet view.
Because those... scenes with her are off-world, they could go anywhere. They're not necessarily in the same timeline as what's happening on Dune. They are, kind of, but not like day by day. So how do you decide, or is it just in the script, where the most effective place to put those scenes is?
There was, you know, there was a moment in the cut where we just went back to the little cards with scene numbers and scene descriptions written on to kind of perfect it. It wasn't, you know, it was it's a really strong script. You know, Denny was really on top with the script. But, you know, there's the flesh and blood thing of feeling when you watch a film, what does the kind of pace, the overall pace of a film? And when I say pace, I don't just mean how fast the cuts are. I mean, you know, what is moving you underneath? What is kind of, what is the big drive in the story? And how do we cross cut those? If you cut off the flow too soon, it's just an age old editing conundrum. In television, you know, television often, Mad Men, for example, is constantly kind of doing the Chinese plate trick of going between different story strands. And that works because of the medium, you know, but in a feature film where you want a kind of strong feeling of drive, it's sometimes a better idea to kind of combine stories or to kind of let them flow. I'm kind of basically playing with Paul's story, the Harkonnen story, and on Jessica laying the way. But Irulan's diaries always gave us an opportunity to clarify their progress. And to that end, Denny shot a beautiful amount of material of the diary room. There were so many more angles we need because he knew that we might need to improvise one. And we did.
There's a fight that is staged, is it for Fade Rotha's birthday or is it somebody else?
The gladiatorial arena. It's Fade's birthday. It's his coming of age.
Yeah, so Fade's birthday is black and white. Was it shot that way?
Well, it looks black and white, but actually it's not. Mm-hmm. It's infrared.
Okay.
Here's an interesting thing. I've always been fascinated by what scenes do filmmakers pick to start with? What do you start on principal photography?
Yeah, meaning the first day of shooting.
Exactly. What do you schedule first? And I had a tiny bit of footage shot in this beautiful mausoleum in northern Italy, which was the Bene Gesserit and Irulan material. But really, the first scene in principal photography was the arena. And first of all, I had no idea that Austin Butler could look like that.
Me neither. Like, who's this guy? He's scary looking.
I met him on set, actually. I sat in his trailer for about half an hour. I was fucking terrified. He is really scary, you know, with his black teeth, like this vampire. And in the first week of filming, they'd had this idea that Gedi Prime, it's a place where the natural world has been long abandoned and it's kind of a plastic place. Mm-hmm. I went into the art department right on my first day in Budapest, and you just end up gawping at this wall of ideas that they've been working on for like a year. And I asked Patrice Vermette, the amazing production designer, what's the inspiration for Gedi Prime? And he said it was black septic tank design. So there you go.
All right.
How did I get there?
But it was shot in infrared, which means it...
So the idea was that it's a black sun that sucks the color out. And black and white wouldn't do what infrared does to the skin. There's two really weird artifacts. First of all, eyes. You know, the vein structure of the eyes is very visible. And there's a kind of waxy quality to the skin where it feels thin and sickly. So this is all great for, you know, the Harkonnens having an advantage over the Atreides, who are used to a lush, watery landscape, you know, and then they kind of come out blinking into this horrendous sun. And of course, the really bold thing is they shot all this stuff and there's no going back. If you don't like it, it's baked in. It's a very, very bold move.
Very ballsy. I love it. You and I have talked about the Kuleshov effect before. I think you said at one point, if you know what that is, you know the secret to my editing.
Yeah, I've got one cheap trick.
Showing a face, then showing something, coming back to the face. There's a place in the film where I felt you used it. Paul's having these visions and you're showing, who's he thinking of?
Yeah, there's a moment with Gurney and Paul where we cut to the nightmare that he's referring to in speech. You know, it was always the intention to kind of ramp up the interior life of Paul in the edit. Like, you know, having learned a lot on arrival on how to kind of structure kind of visions. And then Dune really goes hell for leather for that. And you have to kind of persuade everybody that this guy is capable towards the end of seeing every possible permutation of event. But, you know, in Dune Messiah, it poses a question, if somebody can foresee everything, how do you kill them, you know?
I just have a note that says, vision, water of life.
With Alia, a grown-up Alia. That was interesting. Anya Taylor-Joy was a kind of secret ingredient. Right from the outset, actually, I think Greg showed me an image of somebody standing on a dune in Namibia looking out to sea and saying, we're going to try and do this. It was kind of a secret location. It wasn't on any unit list. And Denny wanted to keep it under wraps. So, for example, even in our test screening, would have a big blur effect on that face. And then, you know, Anya Taylor-Joy came to the premiere and the cat was out of the bag. And we did manage to keep a secret, which is extraordinary.
There is stunningly little exposition in this movie, or maybe it's just because the editing hit it so well, or it's so well hidden in the script. Was there a discussion of how much was necessary to follow a pretty complex story?
You know, look, the difficulty of doing a film that's set 25,000 years in the future is if I was making a film set in Brooklyn in 2024, I wouldn't have to explain to you how cars work. We're in a whole other world where we got shield technology and why do they use swords? Well, you know, we did a lot of that heavy lifting in part one and it really liberated us in part two. And it allows us to feel a lot You know, there's fear and there's love, you know, and there's a sort of anxiety. You know, it's a bit of a treat.
I've talked to people about the fact that you can't really tell by watching a scene which ones are the easy ones and which ones are the hard ones. Mm-hmm. Are there any scenes that were more difficult than you might imagine watching the film that people would not realize was a struggle? Or maybe there was a scene that looks very complicated, but it was a joy and easy to cut?
Well, you know, the Fade-Paul fight at the end is, that's unchanged from the first cut. Mm. But that's not to say it wasn't a hard scene to put together, which it really was. But I was able to devote time to that and make it watertight, only because I had an incredible team that enabled me to have that kind of focus. It was a bit of a treat, actually, for me. I worked with a really talented first assistant, Chris Voutsenas, who, he's an editor, and he's, you know, I was very lucky to have him. He's been assisting for a long time. We met years ago on a Michael Mann film in 2014. He joined us and was a very, very supportive, creative partner in many ways. And it enabled me to give him a few of the smaller scenes to look after and for me to kind of concentrate on the big set pieces, which really, really needed a lot of time and devotion. And that Paul Fade scene, that was a 2-week shoot where you can imagine they have every single cast member in pretty much all the shots. You know, it's a kind of complicated shoot. So, you know, and I've invented a way of working with Chris. I'd always have this, I'll be honest and frank with you, which is that I've always had an anxiety about passing work over to assistants. And I don't mean that as any criticism of people, but it's just the time is so scarce. And June 2, you know, it's the third time in Budapest. And I kind of know the rhythm, and it is a slightly monk-like existence, you know, of going to work early, being in good health, going to the gym, eating well, sleeping well, rinse and repeat. 6 or 7 days a week for 6 months. You have to be super focused. And I found any extraneous effort of trying to teach somebody is just not something I could even, you know, endanger the process with. But with Chris, I found a way of working that I really liked, and it satisfied my need to look at everything. So I know when it's just me and Denny in a small room, that I know everything, so that if he needs some change, I've got a repertory of ways of solving it. So the way I worked on this, and I'm sure I'm not alone in this, is that I got my second assistant, Mercedes, to break a scene down into chunks. And she'd chunk it down into like 30 or 40 second sections and make a string out of every setup of that section, good or bad, you know, scene 31, 31A, 31B, all of the slates. And then to do the next section with a little overlap, so you're not just like bumping into it. And in between those three things is a massive amount of black, so that when you look at it from afar, then you can tell where the second section is, right? So actually I had that running for multiple scenes, including the Fade fight, I think, was a 14-hour assembly of things. It was a lot of chunks. And they were longish takes, but I had to kind of find a way of breaking it down to get what I need for this moment in the story. And that way, if I was handing a smaller scene over to somebody, I mean, Mercedes herself cut a great scene between Shishakli, Charlie and Paul outside this little cave. She cut that. I was able to go through the material, all of it, and then say, okay, what do I really like? And if I really like a performance of a line, or whatever it is, I would climb it up into the timeline. So the V5 means you put that in the cut, or else you can, you know, pack up. V1, don't worry about it, there's better material. V3, V4, you know, these are the ones to kind of concentrate on. And if there was audio that I like separate from video, I could pull that down into 3 and 4, 5 and 6, 7 and 8. And then I'd look through the highlights with Mercedes or with Chris, and then I could say, here's my roadmap. This is a key moment in the scene that you've got to do on this shot. And that was my way of doing it. I kind of was able to kind of keep sort of control in this awful way that I have to. But then I could like look almost like an outsider at the cut that they did. And it's really helpful to be able to kind of assess a cut, probably easier than your own work. Mm-hmm. So it freed me up to be able to do these big set pieces and much more complicated scenes that were involving multiple plates, multiple VFX, and long shoots, like a 44-day worm ride. It just enabled me to keep everything running and not go completely mad.
Mm-hmm. You and I have talked about your fondness and respect for Chris, your first. And it's the big problem with a great first assistant, right, is you want them for yourself, but you also want them to go fly the coop, right? Talk to me about, like, I've talked to so many people who are like, I've got this great first assistant that I don't want to let go of, but they need to be cutting.
There was a project where, you know, I had a long relationship with Javier Marchiselli, who was a brilliant first on 12 Years a Slave. You know, we met in Louisiana in 2012. And then he came up to Montreal. It was just me and him and Denny doing Sicario. And then, you know, numerous films. Yeah. It gets to the point where you're going, yeah, man, you know, there's no signs of you abating your interest in what we're doing. But honestly, you know, Javier Marchiselli, he's a VFX supervisor in the making. And I think there was a show where I said to him, look, you know, I'm going to tell you something. I'm going to ask you something. Which do you want first? He said, ask me something. I said, you know, do you want to work on this next film? The job's yours if you want it. Absolutely. Love to have you back. He said, what are you going to tell me? I said, say no. And then he went off and worked on White Noise, and, you know, his career like gained some strength from that. But yeah, it's really, really difficult because in the cutting room, these relationships are tested under kind of extreme pressure, and that's where diamonds are created. It's very, very hard to let that go.
Joe, thank you so much for talking.
Of course, always. It's like talking to a mate.
That's how I feel as well. Thanks so much.
That's it for Out of the Cut this week. Thank you so much for listening. Again, if you'd prefer to read this interview with visual support and clips and trailers and photos of all the people that are in the interview, head on over to borisfx.com/blog/AOTC, where there's a ton of great expert content for filmmakers of all types. Also, check out my book, Art of the Cut, Conversations with Film and TV Editors for a topic-driven curated look at the craft of editing. Thanks to Joe Walker, ACE, for joining us on Art of the Cut. Get to a theater, maybe IMAX, maybe someplace with great sound, and see Dune 2. Thanks also to our partner, Boris FX. Be sure to check them out at borisfx.com. I'm Steve Hallfish, ACE. Thanks for listening. And please tell all the editors and filmmakers that you know that to get more great Art of the Cut interviews every week, please subscribe on your favorite podcast app. And if you want a good follow on socials, I'm on Twitter and Instagram at Steve Hallfish.